Okay, welcome to a new episode. I'm here in a park, as you can hear, in Taipei, with Gabriele De Seta. Hi.
Hi.
You can't just do some thumbs up, no one's gonna hear.
Right, that's true.
Gabriele, he's done a ton of stuff. Like when we were talking before the episode, I was just saying how much he's been publishing. So basically, you did a PhD in Hong Kong,
yep.
But then have been living in Taiwan for 2 years now?
Yeah, 2 years and a half.
Okay.
I moved to Taiwan right after my defense. And I just started a postdoc here, and then I finished a postdoc here, and I'm still around here. And for the past 2 years and a half, I've been doing research and publishing stuff in the wake of my PhD dissertation.
And so your whole thing is basically internet and China stuff?
Yeah, most of it. I mean, before my PhD, my thing was more music, I guess, in China as well. Music scenes, underground music scenes. But that led, like at the end of my MA, that clearly led into the internet and the role that the internet had for young musicians.
Right.
Because they started sharing music online, so it was way more mediated than performed in live spaces. So that my PhD then was all about internet culture, I'd say, and creativity online.
So maybe we can like start from there. So like, what was the? Can you be more specific about your PhD and what you wrote about there?
Yeah, my PhD was largely a process of figuring out how to write about that stuff, because when I started, I knew that I wanted to write about digital folklore. That's a concept that hasn't been theorized much in media studies. So I just liked it because I thought it really explained well certain kind of things, like, you know, memes and
so
emojis and humor. So digital folklore is the idea that vernacular creativity online is very close to what folklore was 100 years ago or even less. So after media, we still treat certain creative forms of creative content as folklore, as stuff that that's funny or that's interesting or that's like disseminated, circulated in informal ways, and people can join into the creation of it. And it tells stories about media, but they're not official stories, they're, you know, emerging from everyday life. So that's the concept. So I knew I wanted to apply that to, you know, the memes I was seeing in Chinese media at the time. This was like 2011, 12 when I started my PhD.
We also, just like a quick reference,
yeah.
We did an episode with Michelle Proxel like years
ago. Oh, you did
years
for this podcast?
Two years ago,
sure.
I think. So like we'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's like, I met Michelle in Shanghai in 2011, I think.
Okay.
And at that time, like, I remember helping her setting up a Weibo account, and she was into internet art, so like our interests were intersecting at that exact moment, and we got into like looking into weird Chinese online content and memes.
What kind of stuff did you see at the time?
That time was like it was basically in the wake of the train accident, high-speed rail train happened in, was it Wenzhou?
That's what 2011, yeah, that was 2011,
yeah.
Wenzhou.
And so
maybe we need to contextualize that. I'm not sure if people know about
so
it.
So there was a new high-speed train, I think it was the Hexiehao, I mean, one of those, I think, that near Wenzhou, they were running it at super high speed.
Yeah, it's like on the East Coast.
Yeah, Wenzhou is on the south, is like below Shanghai, south of Shanghai. And it's this big Zhejiang city. And this train hit another train car that was parked on the railway. So it was a human error. And a lot of people died, like tens or I don't think hundreds, but like.
But didn't it also like, it just like fell?
Yeah,
like
the train
very deep?
Fell like from a bridge.
Yeah.
And then the rescue efforts, I think, tried to bury it.
Yeah.
To not show the media. So it was a very contested thing, and I've read articles about it afterwards. But what interested me at the time was that people online were making fun, I mean, not fun of the fact that this accident happened, which was terrible, but like making, like parodizing the response of the government
yeah.
to the accident. So there were they were saying, like, you know, the strains that the government pushes is like Chinese achievements, technological achievements, are like traps of death, and you know, the railways are not trustable. Like, literally, that was my PhD proposal. I just got all these memes about railway stuff. They were pretty grim memes. But
what,
like,
was it, like, visually?
Yeah, like the logo of the Chinese railway, high-speed railway, there were like a skull or like stuff about death. And people like keep reposting these photos of excavators burying the train cars to say, you know, there's a cover up. I don't know how much of that was like, you know, real fake news, but it was all this like kind of big accountability, moment of accountability.
Yeah.
You know, the netizens, terrible word, pushing for accountability of like public infrastructure.
Like, I think also just in terms of context, like, that's kind of like the one event that people keep referring back to. In terms of, like, people who study the internet in China,
yeah.
It's, like, the one moment where the internet became, like, a thing, right? Because where it became politically relevant because suddenly people criticized the government, even if it was in, like, memeified and, like, humorous way.
Yeah, I guess before that, I clearly remember at the time I had folders in my computer with all the genres of memes.
Oh, God, yeah.
And, like, this was the most political ones, and the other ones were all the classic ones that everybody talked about at the time, like, 2008-09, like, the grass mud horrors and the crab and all this, like,
yeah,
there are parodies on government speak.
You'll post links to that, but it's interesting that those keep coming up. Like, whenever, I think now when people are like, who don't do anything with China,
yeah,
they talk to me and they're like, oh, this is very fascinating. And they know the crab example.
Yeah.
Like, that's like one thing that they,
I mean,
like,
that's one of the things that pisses me off most about Chinese internet research, that, I mean, I keep seeing articles published today in 2018 that cite as like the only examples of Chinese memes or vernacular creativity or activism online the grass mud horse and the harmony crab, like Tani Ma and He Xie, whatever.
So both of those just,
yeah, they're like homonym, like they're the same sounds for like fuck you. And you can say that, can bleep that.
Well, maybe.
All right, think about it. And like and like grass mud horse, so it's like a more literal translation. So supposedly people in China use different characters to write slurs. And so these were taken as examples of vernacular creativity online. But I mean, most of these were actually pushed by organizations that brought about activism online, like China Media, called China Media, not China Media Project, China Digital Times.
Okay.
They had like this yearbook about like slang terms.
Yeah.
And of course they gave prominence to the more pushy.
Yeah, the ones
terms.
That are visually appealing.
Yeah,
in some
visually
ways.
Appealing. And I mean, I understand they were funny in 2008. but you know, when I did my fieldwork even before my fieldwork, I was just living in China 2009-10, people were just using them as funny curse words. They were already funny because they're so much used and so trite. So if you keep seeing them cited as examples, it would be like seeing, I don't know, memes from 2005 used as explained memes today, stuff like that.
I mean,
that.
Who remembers Western memes of 2005?
Yeah, exactly. It was like if you give the example of like Rick Rolling,
oh God, yeah,
videos today, it would be like, yeah, that's a bit old, right? So yeah, that's one of the things that pissed me off, because over the years I've seen so many things happen in this realm, and so many different political perspectives, opinions, and even non-political trends and positions happen through vernacular creativity that are not limited to like seeing a swear word and saying it in a funny way or something like that. So yeah, but these were the things that were happening at the time.
I think also, like, because you mentioned earlier that you were saying, like, you dislike the term netizens. I think if we want to talk about, like, I think narratives that exist about the Chinese internet, that might also tie into that. So can you maybe explain why you dislike that way of talking about Chinese internet users?
Yeah, exactly. This was one of the things that I didn't put in my PhD. I mean, I put it a little bit in my PhD, and it's still in the folder of things to be written about. But basically, so when people talk about China, they talk a lot about netizens to talk about Chinese users or internet users or digital media users. And I think this is because the government, the Chinese government, adopted a translation of netizens a pretty literal translation of netizens. That's wangmin, like network people, like citizens of the internet, something like that. Because it's like jumin is citizen, resident, so it's like.
Like people of the internet.
People of the internet. Yeah. But it has a little bit of citizenship. Yeah. In it. Like min is always like guomin, jumin, and so on. So the government, of course, uses that term in policy documents and in law to talk about people that use the internet, because it wants to emphasize that these people are subjected to, you know, internet regulations, and they're kind of Chinese citizens online
and
on a national.
Ultimately subject to the control of the CCP.
Yeah, exactly. And they, it's also a positive reinforcement type of thing, in which, you know, if you're called a wangmin, if you're called a netizen, supposedly you should feel like you're contributing to the, you know, greatness of China on the Chinese internet.
Right.
There's a lot of rhetoric about being a good netizen, like a hao wangmin in the newspapers. So academics have kind of, for the longest time, just transposed this term as netizen to say, you know, talk about Chinese people using the internet. So it's like reinforcing this idea that there are some different ways of using the internet in China.
Right.
But what I found out pretty immediately is that people don't talk about themselves as wangmin in China, right?
Yeah.
Like, they would never say, I'm a wangmin, or there's another wangmin. Like, the terms that are used are like wangyou, like online friend, or like user, yonghu, or zhanghao, account. So when they talk about each other online, they talk about, you know, their friends or the people they see posting.
Which is exactly like in the West, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Like another Twitter user.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
so a user, a friend, a follower. You know, talk about how the platforms kind of organize people. So, so I feel the netizen, like this word, has stuck with China as much as, you know, those classical memes from the late mid-2000s has stuck to this image of people, you know, producing content that is against the government, that is a bit subversive, and there are netizens that are, you know, under the control of the government. So it's very closely tied to being a citizen of the internet under the law and going against the law. Yeah.
That's also, I think, like, worth making explicit, because one thing that when I also first moved to China in 2011, I wasn't there that long. But then, especially after I moved back, I got very frustrated with how the internet was only talked about as something that was inherently political. I guess in some ways it is, but it's like Chinese internet culture only got spoken about like in that vein, right? Like it's like people do like crazy protest stuff to oppose the CCP, and that was like this heroic narrative that like plays very well in Western media. But when I talk to friends of mine, and also when I looked at my own WeChat account, like what people post, most of that, like if you go on your Facebook account, like most of that what people post isn't political.
Yeah,
and
true.
The same way in China, most things aren't political.
Yeah, I mean, I had the exact same impression, and that has kind of driven my PhD research, because I did fieldwork, I did, you know, participate on online platforms since, I think I registered my Weibo account in 2009, and QQ, and then, like, tried multiple platforms, and I've always been active on them, and, you see politics sometimes, you know, June 4th, your friends are posting some satire on the fact that the Tiananmen massacre is censored.
Yeah.
But you also see like 90% is like non-political content, or people talking about the US or Germany or Italy or whatever happens.
Food pics,
porn. And, there is political stuff, but it's not necessarily, subversive, anti-government, anti-CCP stuff. I saw as much pro-CCP stuff, extreme nationalist stuff, even from friends of friends, or even my friends that sometimes were like, oh, like the West sucks and China is great because, you know, whatever, like, or like Liu Xiaobo is terrible, right? And you're like, like we should talk about that as well, right?
Absolutely.
There is extremely nationalist, extremely chauvinist stuff on the Chinese internet, and I mean there are some very good scholars that have written about it, like James Leibold. There's plenty of stuff about.
Yeah, we'll link to that. I think some like pretty accessible stuff that he's written that is not behind a paywall.
There are some great papers about, you know, nationalist BBSs like forums and pro-China activism, like all the anti-CNN website stuff.
Okay,
but I thought, you know, this was quite misrepresented when I was doing my PhD. It's somewhat better today, I feel. Perhaps because it has become more visible. Like 5 years ago, it was not that common to talk about you know, Chinese bots on social media platforms or soft power, which is like starting to be figured out. And so today it's somehow easier to talk about, you know, Chinese influence on Facebook or Twitter, or to talk about nationalism and the different forms of like little pinks and nationalist.
What's a little pink?
It's one of other those terms that's been pretty mischaracterized, but like it was used to talk about younger people, like kind of Chinese millennials, air quotes, that are pro-Chinese government or pro-Communist Party policies, like kind of not in terms of a naive nationalism of younger people, they're conservative. Some people have equated to the alt-right, like a Chinese alt-right or something like that. I read another great paper about it, like very recent paper.
Do you remember who it was by?
Yeah, it was Fang Kecheng and a colleague. Yes, I mean, we can link it. I forgot her name.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
But yeah, it was just came out about Little Pinks and how it's been kind of misrepresented. But I mean, I think it's great that there's being more and more work about, you know, what's been called uncivil society in China.
Right. So I think that, like, yeah, no, sorry.
Good. Yeah.
I think that ties nicely into something we talked about also before the show. I think, like, we already talked about like a lot of like misrepresentations of the Chinese internet, especially, I guess one problem is also Western media. Like, even if academia is going into more detail, not of all of that necessarily plays well as a headline,
Like,
which is always a problem. Are there other like common misconceptions about the Chinese internet that you're like annoyed by in general?
Oh yeah, yeah, all of them. But like,
do you want to go with your top three?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give the sense that I don't think. I mean, most of these things are kind of simplified versions of what's going on, and they're not wrong, but they're just like not deep enough or accurate or updated. So like, yeah, the netizen thing. Yeah, sure. I mean, the government calls users netizens, but like, can we go one step forward, right? Another one is the Great Firewall stuff that's, you know, yeah, China has a Great Firewall, but who called it the Great Firewall? And like, when did it start it? And what is it? You know, there's been some great research about it, but then when media talk about the Great Firewall still today, it's always used in a very muddled way to describe like censorship, surveillance.
What do you think are like the things that people should know about censorship in China that are commonly missed?
How it works.
Okay.
And where it comes from.
Like, can you be more specific?
Because, so, the Great Firewall is, like, it doesn't mean anything in the sense that it's a term that a lot of Chinese users embrace to, like, a shorthand to say, I cannot access Facebook and Google and YouTube, and if I post about something on Weibo, it gets deleted.
Yeah.
So, it's like a term they use to say, to acknowledge that they know that some information isn't reachable from China without a VPN, and that, you know, the government has a certain degree of control over the content of social media. On the other hand, it's also a term that's been used in English, I think, since 1999. I think it's an article by Jeremy Barmé and Sang Ye, who came up with the term saying that a government official described the surveillance apparatus that they were establishing as a great firewall. Mm. And so that's what it started to be called. But the origins of it are in, I think, 1994-5, when the Chinese government pushed these golden projects, or infrastructural projects, to set up information infrastructure for the government itself. And one of these projects was called Golden Shield, and it was basically an information system for the police and for public security. So it was just a way for police departments to talk to each other about crimes and to log stuff and make it accountable. So when the internet caught up in the late 90s and early 2000s, this system was slowly repurposed into something about cybersecurity, which is not crime, not just crime, but also crime online. And it increasingly became the infrastructure upon which more systems of surveillance and control were built.
Right.
And this is what we call the Great Firewall.
Right.
But of course, over the years, this has not just been, you know, the cyber police, but it's also like, you know, massive armies of private opinion, not leaders, how do you call them, like opinion workers that are hired either by the government to talk about specific topics or by private companies to fight with each other over like astroturfing. And there is, you know, surveillance at the level of pornography and terrorism that's done by the police and by, you know, public security. There is you know, probably like Secret Service surveillance of activists and Public Security Bureau. I mean, there are many things that when you see them in action, as, you know, this post was deleted or this person was invited to drink tea with the police, you say, oh, that's the Great Firewall in action.
Right.
But there's so many, you know, different levels to it. And so I think, you know, this is hard to say when you've read a 1,000-word article
on
a newspaper. You just say the Great Firewall controls what people do online. Yeah.
Like, I think also, like, adding to that, I think one thing that, like, I often get frustrated with is that people, like, assume that everything is the government's doing generally, and that everything is, like, controlled from, like, I guess, like, a control room somewhere in Beijing.
Right.
But I think one important aspect, for example, is that private companies play a pretty big role in, like,
and local governments. And there's this conflation between governments and party in that Communist Party. There's sometimes, like, oh, the Communist Party controls people through the Great Firewall. I mean, there are many layers of, you know, communication between party guidelines for the media and how, you know, newspapers manage these and manage comments on their articles, and then social media companies respond to these guidelines, and sometimes they get requested to cancel some posts, and sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't delete them, and then they get a crackdown. It's complicated.
Yeah, I think like, for me, one general rule that you could give people if they read reporting on stuff like this, like censorship, if the assumption is that China is like a monolith that is entirely controlled 100% by the CCP, there's likely to be an inaccuracy there. And the story is like a much more complicated one.
And also, we tend to talk about the same things in very different terms when it happen, you know, at home, like in the US or in Europe. If Twitter starts censoring, I don't know, like alt-right people, we talk about Twitter censoring alt-right people, right? And we're like, oh, is this right? Is this wrong? That's good. That's great. That's not good. But we never think of like the massive censorship apparatus of Germany, right?
Right.
It's like, or of the US. That's like a decision that you clearly see the agency, and it can be with the government or against the government.
It's interesting because, like, so in Germany there's a law, right, like that, like, bans certain kinds of like statements about World War II. And it's interesting that there's this tendency, I think, in the US where people say, oh, I changed my location to Germany because now I have a Nazi-free Twitter.
Right.
And it's like this, like, interesting, like, praise of censorship.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess
you
like,
never change your location to China by a VPN to access Chinese internet. Some people do, though.
I've heard that. Like, why? Why would people do that?
Because, I mean, like, I have a bunch of examples from fieldwork and, like, friends that travel to the U.S., for example, and they want to watch videos on Youku or
like
a Chinese YouTube or a Chinese Netflix, or they want to listen to music on Xiaomi, right? Which is like this how is it called? The English
it's like
version.
A music app, like Spotify.
Like Spotify, yeah. And so, and they're like, I can't do it because they're geo-blocked to China, right? Because of rights, intellectual rights. And so they buy a VPN, but instead of using it to access the free, air quotes, internet from China, they use it to access back, like to pretend they are in China and access content that is region blocked. So it is more complicated than that, right? And then when we talk about why don't all Chinese people buy a VPN and just be free, it's because it's not like freedom is not as clear as we imagine it to be. Like, it's not that our internet is everything and the Chinese internet is nothing. It's more like it's a bundle of regional, national networks that people navigate.
So why don't all Chinese people buy a VPN?
A lot of them do.
Do you know roughly? Like, I've seen numbers around that, like 20% of the Chinese internet users.
I don't have like updated numbers, but I think it's clearly an urban phenomenon. Like, there's a clear divide between urban users and rural users. Urban users that started to access the internet with their personal computer in the late 90s, early 2000s, are familiar with how it works. They've used Facebook before it was censored. They've used Google. And when, you know, crackdowns started happening in a visible way in 2009, they just said, all right, I'll buy a VPN and can do what I want.
Right, yeah.
And many of them, over the years, have realized that their local platforms started providing services of similar quality, and so they use the VPN less and less, or they use it just when they need to go on Facebook and promote an event, right? Or talk to one friend, and then for the rest, they don't care. And there's people who still like Google more than Baidu, and so, you know, say, I cannot use Baidu.
Less sketchy ads.
Yeah, exactly. And so they still use a VPN, but there's like a lot of, like, I don't know, like half of Chinese internet users who live in the countryside or in like fourth-tier cities that are perfectly fine of using the internet on their mobile phone, where they started accessing it in, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and they're fine with using local platforms. They don't speak English at all.
Right.
They wouldn't care about accessing non-Chinese language platforms and services, and so they don't even care about using a VPN. They probably could,
yeah,
because it's not hard. You could just go on Taobao and buy one.
So that's like, because there's like they we keep having all these like rumors about like, oh my god, VPNs are going to be cracked down in late March, in late May, in like whatever. Is your like impression that that's still not happening? Or
again, I mean, I haven't done research on this recently, but what I heard mostly is that yes, VPNs will be cracked upon according to regulations.
Will be cracked upon.
but like which ones, right? And it turns out it's the ones that are paid VPNs from foreign companies on the apps, like the App Store or the Android Store. And so the free ones will still be available, and probably the ones that are in China and that abide to Chinese regulations will still be available.
What does that mean?
Well, it just means that they're not encrypted. Mm. They don't offer encrypted connections, so you know, you could use a VPN provided by a Chinese company that's registered with the government, that gives a back channel to the government, so you can still access Facebook, but probably the government can check what you're doing if they want, right? So it just means less security for local users, but also, you know, it's a constant tug of war between regulating this stuff and
right.
and not regulating this stuff or doing it in alternative ways. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's also a matter of political economy, because certain things cannot work without VPNs in a way. Like a lot of company communications need secure VPNs, especially if you work with foreign companies.
Academics as well, because JSTOR, yeah, which sure. is a really yeah. big and important academic database, is blocked.
Yeah, academics. I mean, every time there is this crackdown, there are academics, like, well, even last time, there were academics that sent letters to the government and said, like, we cannot work if we don't have access to academic databases, right? So it's always like a government wants to push certain things and wants to make sure that people are not using VPNs to, you know, organize terrorist attacks, which could be a reasonable thing.
Yeah.
And people want to go on Facebook or watch YouTube, which is also reasonable, and they find ways of doing it. Yeah.
I think, like, one thing also that I sometimes wonder is Facebook gives us the illusion of having, like, there's, like, somewhat an illusion of internationality
right.
and, like, freedom.
Yeah.
But I think if people ask themselves, if they're, for example, based in Germany or Italy, how often do they, like, look at websites that are not based in their
right.
home country? How often do they talk to people who are not based in their home country? And I think one way of conceptualizing, obviously there's Hong Kong and there's Taiwan, but, like, one way of conceptualizing, I guess, the mainland internet is, like, the Chinese internet, like, Chinese-speaking internet is very big, even
right.
excluding Hong Kong and Taiwan, and
yeah.
for a lot of people that's enough. And I'm not sure we can argue, like, of course we have the freedom to access those things in other countries, but I'm not sure people necessarily do that. So I think maybe in some ways that explains why people don't see the necessity to go beyond that.
Yeah, there's like one of the most quoted, I don't know if one of the most, but it's a highly quoted article by Angela Xiaowu and Harsh Taneja, I think 2013, I don't know, 13, 14, I don't remember, but it was an article about web use in China and in other parts of the world, in which they argued quite convincingly that people in China access a cluster of websites that are highly bounded in national terms and linguistic terms. So people in China, just to say like, in a clear way, people in China access websites in Chinese and websites that are based in China, not because of the Great Firewall, because they could also access a lot of websites that are not blocked in China, but they still don't do it because they don't need that information, or they cannot read it, or they have better ways of reaching that information. And that's not more evident in China than in other countries.
Mm.
Like, there are countries that are even more clustered,
localized.
Yeah. So the Chinese cluster is actually quite international when compared with other countries like Japan.
Right.
right? So this article, I mean, I'm not going to the data they use, but it's quite convincing and it's interesting. So, and the thing is, this is just about the web, so
right.
websites. But today, arguably in China, very few people look at websites for the most part of the time, and it's true for Europe and the US as well, right? We access we go online and we think we're going on the internet. I mean, we go on the internet, but we don't go on the web.
Right.
We go on Facebook, like Facebook feed and Twitter feed. And sometimes there are links to the web, but when you open them in the Twitter browser or Facebook browser, like in-app. And so we access platforms, like a highly platformized environment that's very little web-based, and that's, you know, even more national than that. So I suspect that the argument they made about the web still holds, and it's even more true for platforms.
Right,
today, because, like WeChat.
Yeah, WeChat in particular. Yeah. I think also there's, especially as there are apps and services that are very much tied to the real world, like bike sharing,
sure,
and stuff,
yeah,
like that. I think that gets even more salient in,
yeah,
that regard, right?
Like, there's no web. I mean, of course, when you get a bike through, you know, Ofo, there's nothing that happens on the web. Just, you go to their app is, gives you a bike, unlocks a bike somewhere, you get the bike. You didn't pass through the web. You just pass through your provider in China to a server in China and to the bike.
And you need a local provider for that, right? Yeah. Because if you don't have a local provider or an international provider who expanded to your country,
right,
there is no bike that you can,
yeah,
get,
yeah,
through the,
exactly,
app.
And even for, you know, stuff that's more online content-based like WeChat, what you do on it is you talk to your friends inside the app. You pay with stuff inside the app through your bank. And even when you look at posts that people make, they are posts. I mean, they're HTML pages, but they're not on the web. I mean, they are inside WeChat. So they have a web version, but like what 90% of people do is look at the version inside WeChat through WeChat's own browser.
Are you 99? Probably, like, it's...
Yeah. They comment on it through WeChat. So, like, you could almost say that WeChat has built an alternative web that's there. It's not on the internet. Like, on the World Wide Web, we normally know,
yeah,
through the internet. So I think that's way more true today, that, you know, it's the Chinese internet, third air quotes, we use today. It's just, you know, an example of how platforms are making internet use increasingly nationally or regionally or linguistically bounded.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So do people, like, when you talk to people in cities, like, friends you have, are they frustrated that they can't... Does anyone actually have problems with accessing, like, international websites if they're interested in them?
I mean, I have a bunch of complaints because I'm writing about platform use in everyday life, because I'm interested in how this idea of using a platform, not the web, is experienced by people. And yeah, there's people are frustrated, but not just by the fact that they cannot access YouTube, right? Also by how Chinese platforms push against each other. So, you know, you might have a singer who puts her videos on Youku, records herself singing at home, puts the videos on Youku, and then wants to monetize them through, yeah, I don't know, Alibaba or Taobao, right? Or sell something on there. But she cannot put the Taobao link on Youku because they have, like, competing companies, competing investments. And then she complains about it on WeChat, and then realizes that she cannot link to WeChat, to her Alibaba page or Taobao,
yeah,
page on WeChat, because, again, you know, it's Alibaba versus Tencent. And so
the two big companies really right,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and there's also Baidu, which is not as big, but, like, still competing to, you know, buying out smaller apps and companies and integrating them in their massive conglomerates. But they're not, like, a unified, you know, Chinese internet, even if it's off platforms. It's just, like, this massive kind of locally bounded with, like, clear payment systems. They involve, you know, streaming content and services,
yeah,
and they you know, they nudge you into, for example, not paying. You know, if Alibaba buys streaming services, then it encourages you to use Alipay,
yeah,
their own payment service, to pay for your subscription and not WeChat Pay. So so people,
can you even use WeChat
that.
Pay on Alibaba websites at all?
I don't know that.
Because,
yeah,
I think
to do e-commerce,
there was, like, a thing. I think, like, a few years back when I was still living in Beijing, where definitely, like, you couldn't send money between the apps. It was,
right,
possible,
sure,
for a while, and then both apps blocked it. Right.
Yeah.
So you have two digital payment systems, and you just can't.
Two big ones, but I'm sure there are, like,
they're not
10.
Yeah, now,
like,
but, like, I mean, Alibaba and Tencent,
yeah,
are the major ones.
Yep.
And, like, they were just completely not mutually like, operable. Like,
right,
there's just no way of combining,
yeah,
them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know that they keep pushing against each other even, you know, when they buy a taxi company, car hailing company, and then you can only pay with one or the other.
Yeah.
Or for sure, you're encouraged to pay. Like, if you pay with Alipay, then you get some credit. If you pay with WeChat Pay, you don't get any credit. Maybe you pay more. There's, like, tons of this kind of complaints.
Which is ironic, I think, in some ways, because it it speaks to, like, a kind of hyper-capitalism where companies right. will do anything to kind of undermine their colleagues, whereas that would is probably stuff where, like, an anti-monopoly
right,
law
yeah.
would kick in many Western countries.
Yeah, and I think it's because in China there is a... Platforms are more, let's say, work closely with the government, and they're aligned their interests to that of the government to some extent because they want to stay in business. And
right, because so, if you like, if you offend the government, you're
not
blocked.
In business. Yeah, I mean, that's obvious. I mean, Alibaba got the license to set up Alipay. Like, we're the first company in China to get a license for that because they, you know... They worked closely with the government in certain directions. So, I mean, I think all of this goes into the, you know, the idea that people navigate these changes that happen in the internet. They happen quite fast in the internet, you know, from the time where you could not send money, right? You could not use PayPal and there was no way of having an online bank account. It was just 10 years ago to today when you have to navigate like 10 different apps to like pay this and get a cab and check your score. And
when people look at you weird when you say like, oh, I don't have like Alipay or Tencent.
Yeah, so
like,
when I did my field work in the beginning, that was 2000, let's say 14, 15-ish. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, WeChat Pay and Alipay were still not that much used. And I, you know, could go around and pay stuff and very few people were using them. I remember clearly the moment in which people started getting dragged into these payment systems, and that was when Yuebao came out.
Okay.
So Yuebao was this service by Alibaba that, I think, that basically, it was kind of a savings account that Alibaba offered where you could put money.
Yeah.
And the big hype was that it gave an incredible interest rate, and that you can see this interest rate growing on your phone. So people starting putting like 50 yuan, right? Like 100 yuan. And then the next week...
Which is like 10, 15 euros.
Yeah, so 10, 15 euros. And the next week there was doubled, right? It was like 200. Like, oh my God, like this is so much better than my bank account that has like terrible interest. It's like 0.5. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
And so like people putting more and more money into this like savings account. And so Alibaba all of a sudden got a lot of money and it just converted that into... Well, e-wallet and a payment system through which people could actually start paying stuff on eBay. Like it became Alipay that today has become Ant Financial, the big like credit score stuff. So that was the time, and I was like, should I put my money into Yuebao? Because at the time it was really a new thing, and it wasn't clear if it was like a scam or if it was something that would just...
It does sound like a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, at the time it sounded like a Ponzi scheme or something that the government did not regulate yet, but it might, you know, crack down in 6 months. So people were kind of wary about it, but they also put some money in it. It's like, whatever, I could invest, you know. But yeah, at that time it was not something you needed to have. But when I went back in late 2016, it was really hard to live in Shanghai without WeChat Pay and Alipay. And Didi Kuaishe, or like whatever
which
company
is a taxi
was
hailing
it's a taxi.
App.
Yeah, it was. I think now it's called Didi. They merged it with with another, or maybe Didi Kuaishe.
Didi and
Kuaishe
were merged. Yeah, merged. Now Didi Kuaishe. Yeah.
So anyway, it was literally hard to get a cab. Like you would wave at a cab and you would not get it, and then you would get a cab and see that the cab had like 4 smartphones on their how do you call it console, like the car. I don't know the name of that thing, but anyway, in their car, and they were getting calls from the taxi company, but they were also getting people hailing the cab through different apps, right? So they were navigating all these companies to try to make more money because they could, you know, be a private taxi of the company and so on. So it was clearly harder, and it's even harder today. So
I remember when I was back last year, almost exactly a year ago, so I'm like in the spring 2017. It was interesting to see how people are getting selective. So people are now like, oh, you only have WeChat Pay. Well, we'd rather use Alipay, only WeChat Pay if you really have to, because that's somehow like less reliable. So I thought it was interesting because not only, like, so first of all, you looked at weirdly if you want to use cash. Like,
right.
Again, like this urban rural divide, and this was very, like, this was Beijing.
Yeah.
But then not only do you need to use one of those wallets, but like also you need to use the right one
to
pay for your
coffee.
And
this is so pervasive that it's, you know, it's reached very small shops that might not have a credit card POS, right? Might not have,
you cannot, oh God, no, yeah.
Yeah, pay by credit card. So it's either like cash, which they don't really use anymore, right? Or it's WeChat Pay, just scan the QR code and yeah. you have to have the right app. And there are apps only for food and there are apps for like paying cars and stuff. So yeah, that's how pervasive it is.
So what's, let's like try to like loop back to your research for a bit. Yeah. What's like the stuff that you're working on right now? Like what kind of things are you looking at?
I guess like three main areas. I'm working in three main areas, which just happened to follow in my fieldwork was quite, as it happens when you do ethnographic fieldwork, is very disorderly and messy, and I had so much data about so many different things, and it's really hard to then put them together in a thesis. So a lot of it.
Are you an anthropologist by training? Or?
No, I got an MA in something like cultural area studies and a PhD in sociology, but practically my PhD was strongly anthropological training, and I've always written very ethnographic stuff and tried to talk to an audience that's between media studies and media anthropology. So I keep repeating I'm an anthropologist or a media anthropologist, and then I got a postdoc in an institute of ethnology here in Taiwan, so I guess that kind of legitimized me a little bit in pretending to be an anthropologist. But really I think the boundaries are very muddled today, because you know, in sociology you could do highly ethnographic stuff, and in anthropology you could do quantitative stuff if you want, and it doesn't really matter. Like I do studies of media that are based largely on ethnographic studies of how people use this media online, and sometimes I talk about social theory and sometimes I talk about anthropological issues. I can kind of move around social sciences and media studies a little bit. But yeah, so my PhD was really messy, as it's quite normal, I think. And now I'm trying to, you know, focus on different strands of stuff that I left out of my dissertation or I haven't elaborated. And I think the main three ones right now are going a bit deeper on the ideas of digital folklore. So I keep writing about how people make memes and funny things and emoticons and like biaoqing, like stickers on WeChat, and how they actually make them, and how they understand humor, and how they create humor and joke with each other, and how they send this stuff to each other. So just recently I was writing about emojis and how the use of emojis, emoticons and stickers is kind of different in China than other countries.
How is it? Like, or is it too like into the weeds too?
No, I mean, it's just that we call everything emoji, right? When we're talking about very different things. An emoji is a Japanese word that was just like, it indicates a very specific thing. But today on Facebook, you have like stickers, you have like animated GIFs, and you have emojis and you have emoticons and all these things. You can send them, but sometimes you kind of treat them as the same object. And in China, it's interesting because all this kind of stuff is called biaoqing, which means expression. But each platform has its own emoticons. And the emojis, like the ones that are Unicode encoded, are not really used. You know, they're available inside the phone, in the phone system, but most people use platform ones.
That's true.
Yeah, like these are WeChat emoticons, or the QQ ones are really famous. Like they've been used for 10 years and people love them, right? They're so attached to them. And then you have the stickers, and WeChat allows you to put your own stickers that Facebook and other platforms don't do, right? You cannot upload whatever sticker you want. So, but WeChat people like spend 90% of the time exchanging the stuff and building like personalized sticker packs, and there's this whole culture of like biaoqing bao, which means like sticker packs.
So what type of stuff do you see there? Like, I think, I guess the closest equivalent in the West would be GIFs, because a lot of the stickers are GIFs, like some of the very popular ones.
I mean, some are animated, most are animated, but also like non-animated ones. But yeah, it's different because we don't have that culture, but it's not really a culture, it's just like a habit or a thing that's booming in the last couple of years, of having sticker packs like that you can download, compiled by other people, like not official ones mostly. So if you like Jiang Zemin, you can download a
Chinese
sticker
politician.
Pack. Yeah, Chinese politician, beloved former Chinese politician, president,
who allegedly looks a bit like a turtle.
Yeah, exactly. So people love him because this is like cute old guy that lives forever and looks like a turtle or toad. And so you can download, you know, 100 sticker packs about Jiang Zemin and his funny poses, animations, and you just import them in WeChat, and then you can send them to your friends. Where in Facebook, yeah, well, you can download the packs that are offered by Facebook. They're, you know, cute and funny, but they're never over the top, or they're never like parody. Or you can search for animated GIFs, but are provided by like Giphy or providers like that. So they're much less choice in China. WeChat is like amazingly open to user personalization. So I'm writing a little bit about that because I'm interested in how people enjoy this kind of stuff. Yeah, and yeah. Express themselves through this. Yeah, that's one stream. Second stream is something that I started writing in my first year of the PhD. Rather randomly, I wanted to write a chapter about trolling on some Chinese forums. Mm-hmm. I just took a couple of examples from one forum that I usually used to read, because nobody was talking about trolling in a way that was not a panic. Like, I wanted to know how people trolled in other people in China, because I thought it was a funny thing to do. And back then, it was not a huge media topic. It was 2012, 13. So I wrote this article. And then a couple of years later, suddenly, like, trolling is this big media panic in the US. And you have Gamergate. And you have, like, and then you have, you know, alt-right. Like, it's been 3 years, pretty intense. And a lot of books have come out about, you know, great scholarship about trolling. But all of this scholarship, again, has been quite focused on the US or Euro-American examples. Ideas of civility online, ideas of civil society, politeness.
So how is trolling different in China?
Or
is it?
Well, I mean, at the time, 2013, like, I just went through a quite, like, linguistic way of looking at it. So I just asked people if there was any trolling online in China, and they didn't know what the word meant. So I had to explain it, only to realize that they used different terms to describe different kinds of trolling that I was telling them.
And so it's like a typology.
Yeah, it's like different typologies, and some things are considered, you know, quite alright, you know, things that are funny, and other things are considered very harsh, and there are ways that are attributed to gamers, and there are ways that are attributed to, like, boundary making.
Can you give examples of those?
Like, I mean, there were, like, some terms come from Taiwan, like, I think Bai Mo was one, like, white eyes was, like, someone who's, like, harassing other people online, or just,
like, in a sexual way, or just being annoying?
No, just like annoying, yeah. But it also because he's not so proficient, maybe in the platform, so it's a bit like, yeah, like maybe spamming or flaming, could be. And then there is, like, penzi, like, everybody was in penzi at the time, like, somebody, like, the sprays stuff, like, spraying comments.
Oh, okay.
That also came from, like, I think gaming culture, that you're, like, spamming, like, weapons in a game. And that was used to describe people who just, like, attack others in a random way online. And then there were, like, terms that were more like Naotan, like, you're stupid, like, people are stupid online. So I just, like, looked into these terms, and I was like, why there is no one, but it's not a, why when trolling is not a category, like, it's for us, right? Which we tend to put all kind of uncivil behavior online into this big thing and say it's a bad thing or it's a good thing. But in China, it was a bit more, there wasn't a media panic around it at the time. And there hasn't really been up to today. And so I kept doing research on this, and I expanded it a little bit more to idea of civility and incivility. Like, what do Chinese users, digital media users, think about the idea of civility? What does it mean to be civil online or uncivil? What's civil? What's uncivil? And so, again, it was like I did some focus groups, interviews, and asked people about it. And things have changed because now there's a lot more of, you know, astroturfers and companies that are using bots or paid posters, are like the whole 50 cent posting.
Maybe we need to talk about the whole 50 cent thing.
Yeah, so 50 cent thing, I don't know when it started. I think 2010s, early 2010s, something like that.
I feel like for me, forever. Like, since I got interested in the Chinese internet, everyone started talking.
Yeah, I think it was around that time. I don't remember which was the first case, but basically, I don't even know if it was true, but there were reports about people being paid by the government or by the party, or, you know, like, some bureau paid to post stuff online that was favorable towards the party, or like, that was trying to push some opinions, so opinion leading, opinion steering.
Wasn't it primarily about, like, opposing people who criticized the party?
I always feel like that was
the main narrative.
Yeah, it was, like, kind of steering the opinion in certain discussions, right? If you have 100 people saying, repeating a certain thing online, you know, it helps steering the discussion away if it's not clear that these people are paid. So the narrative was that those people were paid 50 cents, so renminbi. It's like a really like nothing. It's like,
nothing.
What, like a cent? I don't know, 5 cents?
I don't know. And one renminbi is like maybe like 10 euro cents?
Yeah, so this will be like 5 euro cents
yeah.
per post. So these people were encouraged to post a lot because posting a lot would mean more money. And anyway, this became a derogatory term. So when more progressively minded people saw a more conservative or pro-party comment, they would accuse that user of being a 50 cent poster. And it became like a kind of code word for like government shill, you know, like shill in the US. Mm. And it's all like it's remained. And then like a couple of years ago, some people started calling themselves Ziganwu, which means like I am a 50 cent poster that does it for himself, so I'm not paid, I just do it for my pleasure because I like the government. So people started appropriating this and saying that they defend the government for free because it's great. So anyway, this like all tied up into a discussion of what is civil, because some people said, you know, 50 cent posters are the most uncivil thing that I see because I want to talk freely online and I want to talk to people that are paid to tell me their opinion. And other people thought that commercial astroturfing was the most uncivil thing because they want to talk about, I don't know, a product and not have like 1,000 positive reviews that are paid for.
Because that defeats the point of product reviews. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And in China, this is way less regulated than what you would have, you know, in the US. There's like much less controls on this kind of content. So
if it's people who want to keep an eye out, like an eye on this for on Twitter, there's countless videos of people who just like sit in front of like a board of like 60, 70, 100 phones and
swipe.
Yeah, exactly. And they swipe or they put like high reviews on stuff.
Yeah, and they have like 9 WeChat accounts on a single phone and they can do like the same post on it like 100 times a second.
Yeah.
So there are like massive content farms. And I guess it's all about like, you know, labor cost in China. So it's not just having factories that produce like cheap products, but you also have factories that create content for, you know, it's easy. You can hire 1,000 people to post a good review of your product on Taobao, right?
It's cheap,
yeah. And so this plays quite interestingly with ideas of incivility, which is becoming a big topic in, you know, in academia, media studies, and sociology, because of all the fake news and Trumps and alt-right and all these debates about, you know, behavior and opinion, reliability online. So that's the second stream of stuff that I'm working on. And the third, it would be moving away from the... I've been a big critic of like always talking about the Chinese internet as you said, a monolithic entity. So I think one productive way of doing this is moving towards talking about platforms and infrastructures and how these two things interact, because you have, you know, on the one hand you have physical stuff that enables digital media to exist, like cables and servers and whatever, data centers and stuff like that, that are in China. They're, you know, national grounds and they have geopolitics, political economies. And on the other, you have platforms that are just things that are popular everywhere, like from Facebook and Google to Baidu and Alibaba. So I think these two terms are quite productive to start understanding better the Chinese internet.
Yeah. I saw someone took photos at WeChat's headquarters.
Yeah,
like,
I saw that as
yeah,
well.
Where there is like a map of like active WeChat users, and you can see obviously like China is like a hotspot, but like, so you have like, I think it's just like intense, like there's like green light on like a dark map of the world for like activity, and like Taiwan, for example, is also like green, like it's just like a bright spot in the middle of the ocean because like a lot of people here are using WeChat, and also on the US East Coast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure that. That is, I mean, that's a photo that someone took in the Tencent headquarters. So it surely has a, you know, they need to push the image of a global media platform that has access, you know, users everywhere. But it's true that in Taiwan, I mean, Taiwan is a very interesting place because for the past year, I've been doing some preliminary research on digital media use here, because when you talk to people, they will tell you, no, we don't use WeChat here. That's a Chinese thing. We use Line. And then you ask them, where is Line from? And they think it's from Taiwan, right? It's true. Line has a Taiwanese, branch, like a local, of course. But it's a Japanese, Korean media platform. I mean, it's owned by Naver. It's a Korean company, but it's developed in Japan. So it is a regional platform that has a specific history, and it's connected to, you know, Taiwanese preference for like Japanese media products and platforms that they feel, you know, closer to their local preference. But then the people also use Facebook, which they mostly think is a global platform, right? Which, you know, is arguably true, but again, you know, the servers are in the US and we have all the discussions about
content moderation is steered by the US in the end.
Yeah, right. And recently, you know, they have all this discussion in Europe about where is the data of European Facebook users, and so where is the data of Taiwanese Facebook users, right? And then I think something happened when Facebook censored some Taiwanese independence advocates.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, for something they had, they posted online, and so there was this big fallout, you know, Taiwanese user for the platforms, and there are not many debates about the role of platforms that are not focused on China and how bad those platforms are, because they're national and they cooperate with the government. But in Taiwan, it's quite interesting to see that sometimes people use platforms without really knowing where their data is going and coming from. And if you go outside of Taipei to like a tourist place where people live with money from Chinese tourists, then you see WeChat QR codes everywhere because people want these tourists
to pay. Even in Taipei, I'm sometimes struck. And I also think one thing that surprises me even here, like you just like, because I, after 2 years in China, like I'm just like, you know what WeChat looks like, right? Like you look at someone's screen and you're like, that is WeChat.
Yeah.
And that happens to me a lot here. People are on it like all the time.
Yeah, and it's mostly because, you know, there's this division in Taiwanese society between, you know, Ben Shengren and Wai Shengren, like people that have been here for a long time, like Chinese people that came in from China like 400 years ago, and people that came from China 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, right? And so people that still have connections to China, family connections, active family connections to China, travel more and you know, use WeChat to keep in touch with their family. And on the other hand, there is people that work, like entrepreneurs that work with China, that do commerce, they also use WeChat because it's the only way to keep in touch.
Right.
And so they have these multiple networks, and it's interesting to see how, you know, how little they're recognized. And of course, Tencent wants to push that, you know, they have a global reach, but it's true that they have a complicated overlay, like locally.
Yeah.
And it's getting more true in Europe as well. Like I have more and more people that use WeChat, just they want to try it. You know, they see in the App Store and they don't like, they're tired of what's happened to try Line or to try WeChat. And then they realize WeChat has a nearby people, you know, search people nearby function, and they realize it's good to get prostitutes. I mean, in Italy, if you use the people nearby function, it's just Chinese prostitutes.
Wow.
Or like, I think even like local prostitution, like, you know, trans, and I'm guessing like prostitution industry, I mean, not industry, but like organized crime that manages prostitution uses WeChat because it's not that regulated. China doesn't really care about banning this account. They don't even know what's going on. And so it's interesting that these platforms become different things in different places.
Interesting anecdote on that is that a friend of mine from the Philippines told me, I think around 2 or 3 years ago, that in the Philippines, only gay people had WeChat. I'm not sure to what extent that is still accurate, but he was saying that essentially also they're using the nearby function to essentially
like
find people to hook up with. Yeah.
But it's you know, you can understand it because, yeah, it is a highly regulated platform in China.
Yeah.
But if
for
you
a very specific situation.
Things, yeah. Right. But if you're abroad and you never go to China and you don't put your credit card, I mean, the international function is more limited. You don't need to give all your data out, and you just use it to like a people nearby function, then it's less moderated than maybe like Grindr. I don't know, like stuff like that. So, I think it's interesting that this, you know, always people do whatever is more convenient for them with the smartphones and in unexpected ways that, you know, then they're reflected differently when you look at the Tencent headquarters. They're like, oh yeah, people are using it everywhere, but how, right? Like,
yeah, actually that would look really bad when they're like, they're using it to find prostitutes in Italy.
Yeah, exactly. They would not put that on the map, right?
So when, if someone says like, oh, I'm worried about using WeChat because then the Chinese government has all my information, like, what is that?
Yeah, I think it's good to be worried. I mean, you should be worried to use Facebook because the US government, and so your government, probably has all the information. But again, I mean, I think it's more about, how do you call it, like, responsible personal literacy, although there's people that don't like, you know, giving responsibility to users. I think that's a matter of literacy, right? Like, if you put your dick pics on Facebook, sure, they're encrypted, so, you know, a hacker is not going to get them, maybe, but Facebook has it. And the person who received it has it, right? And WeChat is the same. So you see people saying, oh, but the content on WeChat, it gets deleted after like 30 days. I don't know exactly, right? Because they see that the content disappears, and Tencent claims that they don't keep any content on their servers. So it's all stored locally and the platform is safe. But then at the same time, the government has access to the back end of the platform. So if they want to check your history, they can check it. So, you know, of course, it's up to you. Like, it's, if you're doing activist, sensitive activist work in China, don't, you know, as all good activists know, don't put it on WeChat, because then everybody knows and you'll be susceptible to things. But, right, if you live somewhere else and you use a fake username or whatever, do what you want. I don't know.
No, that's fair. I think it's just, I think there's like, you often encounter like a general sense of like, not being comfortable with using a Chinese platform, because there's this general sense of ickiness, like kind of disclosing stuff that you about yourself to the Chinese government.
You hear all kind of, you know, terrible stories. I mean, I don't remember, like recently it was something like Tencent started allowing people to register their foreign credit cards on WeChat Pay to do payments, right? So people could started using WeChat Pay abroad. And someone said they registered their card and then instantly got cloned in China. And stuff like that. I mean, of course, as all services, you need to trust the company and trust the security that's there. So getting forbed. I mean, one interesting thing is that, for example, end-to-end encryption is illegal in China, right? So that's why, you know, when you use WhatsApp and you're like, oh, yeah, it has end-to-end encryption, so at least I'm sure that my messages are not stolen from between me and the person that receives them. There is no platform in China that allows that. So if you need that, just find something else. Or just get informed on how these platforms work and where your data goes and what you're putting online.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I also think we probably maybe should wrap up sometime.
Yeah.
We're kind of approaching an hour. Is there anything else you kind of want to, like, stuff that you've, like, done and that you want to talk about more? Or?
I mean, so right. I mean, this is the academic stuff, and then
right.
I try to do some less academic, or different. There's not like writing and talking at conferences to 10 of my friends that I see at every conference, right? So I think like podcasts are great. So I try to do some podcasts sometime, and I try to do exhibitions sometimes that are maybe a little bit related to like China and the internet and digital media.
And you're still doing music as well?
Yeah, right? I do music. I mean, that was kind of my MA research project, and then I kept doing music in a non-academic, like, without writing about it, just doing it with local musicians, first in Hong Kong and then now in Taiwan. And I might go back to music at some point, writing about what I'm doing. But I just think it's a way of, you know, being in a social context in the place you are doing research about that's not related to your expertise. And also to, you know, produce things that are not a peer-reviewed paper that, you know, five people read. I think that's important. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I guess it's an issue, like, if you generally, like, a problem when you're in academia, that it's easy to get that, like, tunnel vision where you just...
Yeah. Unfortunately, maybe it's because I do research on stuff that it's visual and it's easy to present. You know, I could write a paper about Chinese memes, but I could also do like a gallery show about Chinese memes and just put some, you know, projections and screens and do some artworks, and you invite a couple of Chinese internet artists to put their works, and it suddenly it's a different way of talking about the same stuff with, I think, the same depth and,
right.
and but to different audiences and a more maybe immediate way. Or yeah.
So my last question is, can you try to describe, we'll try to, I guess, put them in the show notes, can you try to describe your favorite Chinese memes?
My favorite Chinese memes, I think, let me think. So I think my favorite is still Jinko La.
Okay.
It's pretty old, but it's so rich.
Can you describe?
And relevant? Yeah, sure. So Jinko La is a product, like a fertilizer. I don't even know if it's a fertilizer or like some kind of agricultural, how do you call it? I don't know the terms because I'm not a farmer, but it's like a bag of stuff that you're supposed to put on your like
field
when you're on your field or when you're tilling it, I don't know, or putting seeds in the ground. Anyway, that I makes it a lot better and gives you like a higher yield of stuff. And it was made by some Chinese company, like some rural company, that called itself American Shangdiago, which according to, I mean, it's the transliteration of San Diego, America. So they wanted to say that they were from the US, but they used like a Chinese transliteration, so it was clearly not from there. And they made, I think around 2010, 12, like something like that, they made some advertisement on TV that got reposted online because it was so absurd. And the advertisement had, it was different clips, and it had a black guy, like I think an African guy, probably they just got an African student in China to act, and an older Chinese guy that had a mustache, a little mustache, and was acting the Japanese devil, right? And a Chinese, no, and a white guy, like a middle-aged white guy that was supposedly from the American Shangdiago company.
Probably also selling.
Maybe more like English teacher, that type of guy. Yeah, and so in these these advertisements, these three characters were acting something in which the American, the middle-aged American, was asking why the Japanese guy and the African guy wanted this product, because this product was so good, and to give him reasons to give them the product. And the Japanese guy was saying, oh, the Japanese agriculture is not so developed, like it's not as good as China, we need this product, please. And the African guy was like, oh, no, Africa really needs it because we're also not developed, please give it to us. And then the white guy was like, ah, you're a Japanese devil, I'm not giving it to you, I'm giving it to the African guy. And so this product became, of course, like a meme, in the sense that people would post the image of the product because it was funny, and they would post stills from the advertisement because it had this African guy speaking Chinese and the white guy speaking Chinese, and it was like the Japanese devil being like a super stereotype figure in Chinese TV. And so that the very name Jinke La started to signify like bad Chinese products, like countryside commercial products, almost scams, because I'm sure this product was not even like, it was probably a scam, like it was useless, but it was sold to farmers to tell them that it would make their life much better. And you know, as usual, there were like remixes, and there were parodies, and there were like songs made out of it, and it's still going, it's always like one of these evergreen memes, but it's so layered with like geopolitics, so you can see the image of the white, like American guy, the American company, the locally made product that is made to look like as if it's like an international thing, the African guy, and the idea of like Sino-African ties, and this,
and also like then like the animosity with Japan,
the anti-Japanese sentiments, and all this like, and it's shot in a terrible like amateurish way someplace in the countryside, and it's just like, it's amazing.
I need to look that up. Yeah.
I wrote a short essay, like a visual essay about it a few years ago, that explains a little bit.
Can we link to that?
Yeah, we can link to it. Yeah, it's online.
Yeah. Cool. That sounds like that's a great ending too.
All right. Yeah, I hope so.
Well, thanks so much for making time.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope the grannies dancing in the background weren't too loud with their music.
No, they're gone. Everybody's gone.
Yeah, so, I guess it's almost 10. Everyone's bedtime.
Yeah, and we haven't been kicked off the lawn.
So yeah, we've been sitting on the grass.
Thank you, Taipei City Government.
New Taipei.
New Taipei City. Oh, right.
Yeah.
We're abroad.
Cool. Well, thanks again.
Yeah,
and,
thank you.
Yeah.
Wrap
until
it up.
Next time.
Yep.